Today, we begin our deep dive into Stanley Kubrick's The Shining. We'll explore the hidden layers in the film's first half, from Jack Nicholson's haunting presence to the red Volkswagen bug, Playgirl magazine, and the portal symbolism of mirrors. We'll uncover ties to MKUltra, Project Monarch, Illuminati bloodlines, and Room 237's link to Bluebeard and incest. What Kubrick's really telling us about America, dream logic, and mind control. This isn't just a horror film, this is a ritual. Let's begin. Now, if you don't know me, my name is Isaac Weishaupt, not my real name, and I am your host of Occult Symbolism and Pop Culture, and this particular film analysis is years in the making. Years. This was actually the third book I wrote back in 2014, was Kubrick's Code, analyzing four of Kubrick's films: 2001, A Space Odyssey, The Shining, A Clockwork Orange, and Eyes Wide Shut. Almost forgot the fourth one, the most important one, Eyes Wide Shut. And The Shining is a film that somehow, over the years, I've never done a full film analysis. So I'm more than excited to begin this journey with you. It's going to be a three-parter, okay? Today, we begin the deep dive with part one. We'll explore the cast members, like Jack Nicholson. We'll do a little deeper dive into Jack Nicholson. We'll talk about the movie poster. We'll talk about like the sort of making of the film type behind-the-scenes stuff for the first maybe half of this episode. Then in the second half of the episode, we're going to start getting into the film. We're going to go through the first half of the film itself. And part two, which I'll drop as the next episode, we're going to finish the second half of The Shining. Then in part three, which is going to be super long, I'm going to break down what all of this means. What's the symbolism? What are the messages? What's really happening with this film? And why is it so important? Okay. Part three is going to be the banger, all right? Part one and two, it's just going to be a great time. So without further ado, let's get through it. The symbolism that we're going to talk about today a little bit, we're going to touch on. But again, in part three, we're going to unpack it a little more fully. Today's symbolism from the first half of the film, we'll talk about the red Volkswagen bug. We'll talk about David Lynch, Stephen King, Catcher in the Rye, America, MKUltra, Project Monarch, Portal Mirrors, Cannibalism, Playgirl Magazine, Incest, Illuminati Bloodlines, Calumet, a book called Cult and the Occult, which shows up in my 6-7-part Eyes Wide Shut analysis I did not too long ago, Dream States, Bluebeard, and Room 237. Now, I'm going to preface all three of these parts, all three of these episodes, with explicit language warnings, F-bombs, and such. So, if you're not into that, these three episodes, you're not going to want that, okay? You can't play this in the minivan with the kids. It's going to be F-bombs, unless you're a cool parent like mine, and you're like, okay, whatever. So your choice. I'm giving you the warning right now. Also, trigger warnings for, we're going to talk about some sexual assault things, incest, that sort of thing. So if you're, you know, sensitive to that, I'm letting you know right now. All three parts, we're going to kind of touch on those subjects. And I'm going to also be playing some clips from the film, in fair use, of course. And if you're on the audio-only feed, you may hear me stop talking for a minute while the background clip finishes playing. And you'll just hear the audio from the clip. So, you know, it might sound a little weird. I don't know. Whatever. The video version of the show is the best way to do it. You go tier 2 on Patreon or VIP section, and you get the ad-free video, early access to work. So if you want to support the show, you want the video version where you're going to see the clips, you're going to see the images that I'm talking about because I put them on the screen. I painstakingly edit these things. Boy, oh boy, is the video a lot of work. Anyway, if you want that, go tier 2. All right. Then finally, I want to dedicate the show to Shay. She's given me many pieces of beautiful Kubrickian art over the years, and it's all on my beautiful wall of art behind me in the studio here. So shout out to Shay. Now, as I always do with my film analysis, should you watch this movie before we talk about it? Yeah, it's typically ranked as the best horror film of all time. And to be fair, I mean, rightfully so, I think. Is it the scariest? Is it the goriest? Not particularly, okay? Is it the most engaging into the subconscious mind in one of the most unsettling films ever? Absolutely. High rewatch value, great movie. Is it my favorite horror movie? I don't know. I'd have to sit down and really think about that. I got a lot of favorite horror movies. And it depends on what you're looking for, right? If you're looking for a scare, you're looking for some gore, maybe this isn't the one for you. What's it about? It's about 2.5 hours. It's about 2.5 hours, honestly, though, which is typically, you know, I hate anything more than 90 minutes, but if it's a Kubrick movie, for some reason, it gets a pass with me, you know? That's why I've got Kubrick shining tattoos and crap all over my arm. I absolutely love Kubrick and Twin Peaks. They both sort of have that psychological element to them. Now, the movie is, of course, based on the 1977 novel by Stephen King. And within a few years of that novel's release is when this movie came out in 1980. Stephen King goated as well. I grew up reading Stephen King books. He's the best. I don't read a lot of fiction books, but Stephen King, I can read fiction when it's Stephen King. Now let's talk about the cast. Jack Nicholson plays the main, well, I guess the main character is Jack Torrance, right? The dad. And goated actor. Easy Rider, Chinatown with his BFF Roman Polanski directing. We're going to come back to that. A Few Good Men with my BFF Tommy Salami, second greatest actor of all time. Batman, the original 89 Batman, the good one with Michael Keaton. He played the Joker, which ties him into a whole lineage of bad mojo, right? You tie into that Joker archetype from the tarot card. Bad deal. He was also in The Departed. Now, fun facts about Jack Nicholson. I was looking into his Wikipedia. Apparently, he doesn't even know who his father is. I didn't know this. Says that his mother married an Italian-American showman named Donald Forcillo in 1936 before realizing that he was already married. People were wild back in the day, weren't they? Biographer Patrick McGilligan stated in his book Jack's Life that Latvian-born Eddie King, June's manager, may have been Nicholson's biological father rather than Forcillo. Other sources suggest June Nicholson was unsure of the father's identity. As June was only 17 and unmarried, her parents agreed to raise Nicholson as their own child without revealing his true parentage, with June acting as his sister. Yeah. In 1974, Time magazine researchers learned and informed Nicholson that his sister, June, was actually his mother. And his other sister, Lorraine, was really his aunt. By this time, both his mother and grandmother had died in 1963 and 1970, respectively. On finding out, Nicholson said it was, quote, a pretty dramatic event, but it wasn't what I'd call traumatizing. I was pretty well psychologically formed. Can you imagine that? That's crazy. You grow up thinking this woman's your sister, that's your mom? Insane. He was in the California Air National Guard for 5 years. He does the film Easy Rider. That's kind of his breakout role. That's what got Kubrick's attention. He actually wanted Jack Nicholson to play the role of Napoleon in a film that, in the history of Kubrick, is the stuff of legends. He was going to make this Napoleon movie. Never came to be. In William Snyder, a.k.a. Recluse, he has a book called The Minotaur. He details how connected Kubrick actually was with Jack Nicholson. He had Nicholson checking in on his own daughter, Vivian Kubrick, when she moved to L.A. Because, you know, Kubrick's story. He moved to England and never came back to America. And Jack had stayed in touch with Kubrick throughout his entire life. He even attended Kubrick's funeral. And there's a strange web connected in the book by Recluse that goes back to Vincent Bugliosi, who convinced Paul Perveler of, or convicted Paul Perveler of a murder. And this guy was actually Kubrick's first cousin, Paul Perveler, who wasn't the murderer, apparently. And from here, you get into, from Bugliosi, you get into Charles Manson, and you get into Roman Polanski. Of course, you probably know the story of all that. Thus, Jack Nicholson and even Kubrick were alleged to possibly have the sex tapes like Roman Polanski was alleged to have. I know if you're not familiar with that whole backstory, you're probably like, what the hell are you talking about? Well, it's a long story, but that's the claim, is that Polanski and Sharon Tate would have these sort of Hollywood orgies, and even that the Manson family was there selling drugs and crazy stuff. And then Tom O'Neill's Chaos book basically confirmed those sex tapes. Well, I don't know if confirmed. I read it years and years ago when it came out. I remember reading something about the sex tapes having more plausibility than not. So Jack Nicholson was buddies with Roman Polanski, the director. And remember, you know, his wife Sharon Tate, murdered by the Manson family. And 3 years after filming Chinatown, which starred Jack Nicholson, Polanski was actually arrested at Jack Nicholson's home for sexually assaulting a 13-year-old girl. Jack Nicholson was out of town, to be fair. So there's this whole thing about Roman Polanski, right? And Roman Polanski, of course, filmed Rosemary's Baby, his wife Sharon Tate murdered by the Manson family. He evaded capture and moved overseas. He filmed The Ninth Gate with Johnny Depp, a very occulted movie, Gnostic movie. Yeah, there's a lot there. Now, for the role in The Shining, Jack Nicholson drew upon his own experiences as a writer, and he actually was sleeping very short hours to help remain in a state of agitation for the shoot. And his co-star Shelley Duvall recalled that she and Nicholson spent many hours discussing their character, with Nicholson maintaining that his character needed to be cold to her right from the start, which is not how the book is. The book, Jack Torrance, is a very loving husband and father. He's a very good dude, right? He just has these struggles. Whereas the movie, The Shining, Jack Nicholson's just like this psychopath right off the bat. Now, Jack Nicholson's love life is pretty insane. 6 kids to 5 women. He was married once to a woman named Sandra Knight in the 1960s. He also dated Michelle Phillips, who was previously married to Dennis Hopper, who was besties with Jack Nicholson because they were in Easy Rider together. Dennis Hopper, of course, in occulted type films. He was in Curtis Harrington's Night Tide, which has Whore of Babylon type stuff going on in it. He was in Blue Velvet by Lynch and so on. He was affiliated with Kenneth Anger for a period of time, I believe. So Michelle Phillips, she's famous for, she was in The Mamas and the Papas. She was married to Papa John Phillips. And John Phillips's daughter to a previous marriage named Mackenzie Phillips alleged that her father incestually abused her for years and forced her to take drugs, and that she had actually got impregnated by him. And Michelle denied that. She's like, there's no way he could have done that. Mackenzie apparently had some drug addictions. Who knows what's the truth there, right? But Michelle and Papa John had a child on their own named China Phillips, who was one of the singers in the band Wilson Phillips. Lots of weird 6 degrees of separation here. Jack Nicholson dated Angelica Houston. She was actually the one that called the cops on Polanski because he was in the hot tub with this 13-year-old girl and whatever. And ironically, Angelica was 17 when she started dating a photographer named Bob Richardson, who was 41 at the time. Also, Bob Richardson, his son is Terry Richardson, a photographer notoriously accused of sexual misconduct for a very long time. He got involved in the Me Too stuff and hasn't apparently been working since. Angelica dated Terry's father, Bob, for a month before she met Jack Nicholson. So she was 17 when she hooked up with Jack Nicholson, who was 36. Crazy stuff. Jack dated Bond girl Jill St. John. Then he dated a model, Winnie Hallman, with which he had a daughter named Honey in 1982. In 1999, it was brought to light that Honey's real father was actually Lou Adler, who was the manager of the Mamas and the Papas, and he was also one of Jack's close friends. He also had a child with Britt Eklund, who was the blonde woman in Wicker Man, who I also have tattooed on me, by the way. He also dated Lara Flynn Boyle in the late 90s, early 2000s. Of course, she is Donna from Twin Peaks, the much beloved Twin Peaks, which is interesting because he was in A Few Good Men with Tommy Salami, as well as James Hurley. So James Hurley was dating Lara Flynn Boyle on the show Twin Peaks, right? James and Donna were dating as part of the storyline. He also dated, Jack Nicholson also dated Kate Moss, also friends with Hunter S. Thompson, attended Hunter S. Thompson's funeral as well, along with Johnny Depp, John Cusack, and Sean Penn. And this was the funeral where they blasted Hunter Thompson's ashes from a cannon on his location called the Owl Farm, which ties us into Minerva and the Goddess of Wisdom. Also ties into the Illuminati, Bohemian Grove. It also ties us into Hunter S. Thompson, who wrote about adrenochrome. I mean, we could do an entire show about Jack Nicholson, I'm guessing, based on all these close affiliations to a lot of major themes in the history of conspiracy and esoteric. The next main character, Danny Lloyd, he's the young boy in The Shining. He plays Danny Torrance, Jack Torrance's son. When they filmed this movie, he was only 6 years old, which is crazy because it's so horrific. But they told him that he was filming a drama movie. He didn't even know he was filming a horror movie. He actually retired from acting immediately after this film in 1982. He was actually in a TV film called Will G. Gordon Libby. But he basically retired from acting. Why? Not sure. He had a cameo in Dr. Sleep, which is... So Stephen King wrote The Shining in 1977. Then, I don't know, what was it, 20, 30 years later, he writes Dr. Sleep, which is the sequel follow-up to The Shining, where Danny Torrance is an adult. And then they made a movie about it. Well, the kid who played Danny Torrance in The Shining was also had a cameo in Dr. Sleep. He was a person watching a baseball game, so... whatever, right? But he lives a very personal life, apparently. Doesn't even talk about his life or The Shining or nothing. No Comic-Con signings, nothing. What happened on that set? Maybe nothing. Also notice the play on names here. Kubrick casts Jack Nicholson as Jack Torrance. He casts Danny Lloyd as Danny Torrance. And later, there's a bartender named Lloyd, which is the actor for Danny Torrance's last name, Danny Lloyd. And it's very reminiscent to the strange connections to be found in David Lynch's Twin Peaks with Bob and Bobby, Mike and Mike. And both stories have this weird dreamlike effect that becomes a nightmare. And there's also the name game with Jack Torrance. In the book, he goes by John Torrance. But back in old-timey days, they used to call John's Jack. So, like, you know, John F. Kennedy, John Parsons, they would be called Jack. Don't ask me. That was before my time. And now everyone else I'm going to talk about from the cast on this list is dead. Sadly, tragically, all dead. Shelley Duvall played Wendy Torrance. She just died July 11th, 2024. Rest in peace, a year ago. And boy, did she have a great 1980. She was in The Shining and Popeye. She played Olive Oil. Loved that movie as a kid. Kubrick, apparently on the set, was kind of mean to Wendy, or to Shelley Duvall, I should say, because that was the reaction he wanted her to have for the film. She claimed, though, that Kubrick was very nice to her, but everyone else says otherwise, so who knows? On today.com, there was a discussion about this. It says the movie shoot took a whopping 56 weeks, with Duvall and Nicholson putting in up to 16 hours, 6 days a week. Kubrick, who died in 1999, famously demanded his actors reshoot scenes over and over, even earning a mention in the Guinness Book of World Records for the most retakes for one scene with dialogue for one Shining scene featuring Scatman Crothers and child actor Danny Lloyd that was shot 148 times. I'm going to play that scene for you later. Kubrick doesn't print anything until at least the 35th take, Duvall recalled to the Hollywood Reporter. 35 takes. Running and crying and carrying a little boy, it gets hard. And full performance from the first rehearsal, that's difficult. One of the movie's most famous scenes features Jack stalking a sobbing Wendy up a staircase as she clutches a baseball bat to protect herself from her suddenly deranged husband. Kubrick made Duvall Nicholson shoot the scene 127 times. Oh, Kubrick's insane. And I'm going to play that scene for you too. All right. Because that's peak Jack Nicholson. And there's an urban legend that Tommy Salami holds a record for the retakes with the film Eyes Wide Shut. But that's not true. Kubrick had Tom Cruise walk through a doorway 95 times, which is less retakes than The Shining. So he let him off easy. The Eyes Wide Shut record that they have is for the longest continuous film shoot at 400 days. And he would do these retakes to exhaust the actors to get a more raw performance, build natural tension, and so on. Scatman Crothers plays Dick Halloran. Fun fact, he was the voice of Jazz on the 80s Transformer cartoon show. He got his name Scatman because he was a musician. Barry Nelson plays Stuart Allman. He was actually the first James Bond. I also have that tattooed on me on my arm, 007. Wait, where is it? On my left arm. 007, which ties us into the world of John Dee, right? The first occultist Secret Service agent. But there was a TV show called Casino Royale before the films became a thing, and Stuart Allman was James Bond. Fun fact, Wikipedia says Bond wasn't even a popular story in America until JFK listed the book From Russia with Love as one of his top 10 favorites. Strangely enough, as we're going to find out, Barry Nelson, who plays Stuart Allman, looks very similar to JFK in The Shining. Also, you can add him into that growing conspiracy about the 1982 film Poltergeist because his last role in a film was as an uncredited role as an actor on television. Of course, he would go on to keep working on TV, but his last film role was on the Poltergeist movie. And he didn't die until 2007. So, I mean, depends how crazy you want to get, but Poltergeist was technically his last film that he did before he died. So add that into the mix of other Poltergeist curses. Philip Stone plays Delbert Grady. He was actually in A Clockwork Orange as Alex's dad. He was also in Barry Lyndon. I haven't seen that yet. I tried. It's so boring. I'm gonna watch Barry Lyndon someday. And he was in Indiana Jones Temple of Doom. Tony Burton plays Larry Durkin, a very minor role, but he was a guy named Duke in the Rocky movies, and he was only supposed to be on the set for a week for The Shining, but apparently he was really good at chess, and he beat Kubrick, and they would play for weeks. So they kept him around just to play chess with Kubrick. Barry Denon plays Bill Watson, that's Stuart Allman's helper. He's in the movie for like 2 seconds. You blink and you miss him. But this guy was a legend. He played Pontius Pilate in Jesus Christ Superstar. He was in the Batman 60 show. Also love that. He was in the Tales from the Dark Side show. Loved that growing up. He was in Trading Places. He was in Superman 3, the one with Richard Pryor. Titanic. And the sequel to Rocky Horror Picture Show, Shock Treatment. If you haven't seen that, I did a full film analysis of it. It's actually much more seeped in occult esoteric ideas from what I remember. Did that several years ago. In fact, I had a listener who loved it so much, and he gave us a rendition of a song that we put on the episode. So if you're a Rocky Horror nerd like me, and Shock Treatment's pretty good. At the first glance, you're disgusted. At first, you're like, what is this trash? When you're used to Rocky Horror, but if you honestly sit back and be open-minded about it, you're like, this is actually pretty good. And then last, but definitely not least, director Stanley Kubrick, the legend. Behind the Shining, 2001 Space Odyssey, Eyes Wide Shut, Clockwork Orange, Full Metal Jacket, Doctor Strangelove, and of course directed the fake moon landing footage, as we'll discuss. Now, Kubrick is such a legend. You have to understand, he's got he didn't do that many films, but the ones he did rank so high. Like The Shining ranks as one of the best horror movies of all time, like the best by most countdowns. And 2001 A Space Odyssey is ranked as the best science fiction movie of all time. Sometimes the best movie of all time. That's impressive. It's not like he's a one genre dude. Like, this guy was a genius for sure. But he is very similar to David Lynch in that he has a way of connecting to the subconscious and using symbolism and all that. In fact, they admired each other's works. He screened David Lynch's Eraserhead for the cast of The Shining to show them the atmosphere he wanted to create for The Shining. Which, if you've ever seen Eraserhead, it's pretty weird. And we're going to talk about it later. There's a scene that's reminiscent of, like, the Room 237. That whole vibe is from Eraserhead. And Kubrick, a very enigmatic figure, a gifted photographer, moved on to film, considered a genius. He was very into surrealism, had many high-profile connections to various worlds of entertainment and politics, possibly intelligence agencies. He left America in 1961 to move to England, where he stayed the rest of his life, never came back to America, and he loved New York City, so it's something happened there. He, in fact, for Eyes Wide Shut, it's supposed to take place in New York City, so he recreated the streets of the hometown from, to the specifics where they would measure the newspaper stands. And there's lots of conspiracy theories about Kubrick. I mean, tons, right? Some say he's a bad dude. Some say he's a good guy trying to expose these satanic elites and these pedos. Some people say, no, he was running in those circles with these pedos. We'll come back to all of that, all right? Then we got the movie poster. Because looking at a movie poster is actually quite important. It's basically the cover of the book. It's a way of distilling an entire film into one image, right? One shot. It's one massive symbol that tells the whole story. So we've got to look at the movie poster. And this movie poster is bizarre. It's yellow. It's got the T for The Shining has this sort of face in it, but it's not really a face. There's no one from the movie really on this poster. It's a big mystery. It's like, what the heck is, what are we looking at? Right? Some people think that what you're looking at is not a face, but the dials of the elevator where the blood spills out. It was designed by a guy named Saul Bass, and he did a lot of movie posters, sometimes with his wife, Elaine Bass. They did posters for Hitchcock's Psycho, Vertigo, Goodfellas, Cape Fear, Casino. And Saul was a master of corporate logos, which makes me think that Kubrick selected him for his knowledge of speaking to the subconscious, because he did corporate logos for AT&T, Warner Brothers, Continental, United, Hanna-Barbera, Quaker Oats, and a lot more. Anyways, the point is that the poster is showing us that this film has surreal elements that are supposed to speak to the subconscious. That's why it's such a creepy film. Now, before we start the film, quick word about my analysis. Kubrick paid obsessive attention and detail to his film and his edits and his shots. That's why there's this whole field of conspiracy devoted to the guy. Some people call it crypto-Kubrology. Kind of like Lynch, right? They'll say a film is Lynchian or Kubrickian. So there's the whole sort of vibe that these guys have. And lots of folks have been talking about Kubrick and The Shining before me, right? But even more people came after me. So at this point, it's difficult for me to pay homage to the correct person, because now, like, everyone's a conspiracy theorist, right? And there's many other sources you could dig into for this kind of stuff. Back when I wrote Kubrick's Code, there wasn't a ton of stuff out there. I was intrigued by the ideas of Kubrick and conspiracies through Jay Widener and his Kubrick's Odyssey series, which is one of the major influences of why I wrote Kubrick's Code. Now, unbeknownst to me, while I was writing Kubrick's Code, a documentary by Rodney Asher called Room 237 comes out discussing various ideas of conspiracies behind The Shining. And they interviewed Jay Widener, thank goodness, right? Major update, folks. I've had to move my online store from Gumroad to my own website, so now you can find all of my author-signed books, super soft shirts, and a brand new health grift, my own branded mushroom-infused coffee called Mushroominati Watcher Coffee, all at occultsymbolism.com. I've written 9 books so far, working on a couple more right now, and you can pick them up, signed from my shaky, callus-laden CrossFit hands, and shipped to your door. There's also a couple of bundle deals you can take advantage of, like my Oops All the Books bundle. And of course, I've got those Super Soft Podcast logo shirts that say, "These nerds are going to kill us" on the back. Never been more appropriate than in our modern times. You'll have people stop to tell you they agree with you and that you're super cool for listening to Occult Symbolism and Pop Culture. Finally, I've got this new product. I worked with my coffee plug from San Diego, Jordan, to give my listeners the best mushroom-infused coffee on the planet, called the Mushroominati Watcher Coffee. It's a whole bean coffee with flavor notes of candied orange, sugar, and plum, but more importantly, it's infused with 6,000 milligrams of mushroom extract, reishi, chaga, mesima, lion's mane, turkey tail, shiitake, blaze, agaragon, and oyster. It's one of the healthiest mushroom blends, and it becomes bioavailable when you infuse it into the coffee. I read this whole book on medicinal mushrooms by Christopher Hobbs. He goes through the countless studies that prove the effectiveness of supplementing a healthy lifestyle with mushrooms for physical and mental superiority. It's like you're plugged into an electrical socket, and it tastes so good. You won't believe that there's mushrooms in there, because I've tried several mushroom coffees in an effort to get more mushroom supplementation into my life, and they're terrible. But not Mushroominati Watcher Coffee. Super smooth. Finally, if you're on Patreon or VIP section, I had to update your 10% off discount code, so check out the show notes for your new code that you can use at occultsymbolism.com. I can't offer the 10% on the coffee, though, because the profit margin is so narrow, I'd be losing money on every sale. So there you go. Support your favorite independent voice and podcasting at occultsymbolism.com. Links in the show notes. But there's a lot of books and theorists out there. I just listened to a guy named, I think his name is Alex Fulton, on Higher Side Chats. He kind of gets into the numerology of it, which isn't necessarily my bag, but it was an interesting interview. Recluse William Snyder wrote a book called The Minotaur. I've got it over here. I read it for this analysis. I also watched Room 237 again. And then I looked through my own book, Kubrick's Code, from 2014. Which, by the way, quick plug, if you want to get a PDF copy, an ebook of Kubrick's Code, where I walk you through the symbolism of 2001 Space Odyssey, The Shining, Clockwork Orange, Eyes Wide Shut, it's a very beginner's level book, because I've learned so much since then, but you can get it for free along with my most popular book, The Dark Path, where I break down the entire global agenda about how it all fits into entertainment by signing up for Patreon, patreon.com/IlluminatiWatcher. Just sign up, $5, you get in, boom, free books, bam. Or you can get them on Amazon or Audible, I narrated them. So there you go, quick plug. Now, I published Kubrick's Code in 2014, and my memory from what I recall is that so I try to give as much credit and homage to people that I could at the time. But there's some things that I believe I get credit for, you know? I know that's very ego-centered, but sometimes I see stuff and it bugs me. Like, there was this video on YouTube with millions of views, and the person talked about how Jack Nicholson's standing like the Baphomet, go with the bobs. I was like, hey, man, I wrote about that in 2014. Like, now, it could be that they just figured this stuff out on their own, too. Like, right? But some of this stuff is like, it's my pride and joy a little bit, you know? Like the twin pillars at the beginning of Eyes Wide Shut, I had to come up with that. And I've seen that in some other people's stuff without naming names. I've seen people talk about these things, and I'm like, boy, that's interesting. And then the ending of Eyes Wide Shut with Helena getting taken away by the pedophilia elites, I came up with that too. Everyone's talking about that now. I say that because I try to pay homage to theorists like Jay Widener before me who have talked a lot about this stuff. Anyway, So, and also one last thing before we get into the movie part one is, I would recommend the video version of this episode. If you have the, if you're on the Patreon or VIP section at tier two, you'll get access to that. I'll be discussing a lot of images, playing a lot of clips. Now, Free Feed Losers, you're gonna get a video version, but you're gonna get it late. Usually a week or so. You're gonna have pesky ads, but I upload it to my YouTube at Occult Symbolism, my Rumble at Occult Symbolism, and my Spotify. Okay, so if you want to wait like a Free Feed Loser, you can watch the video late, but you're gonna get all the ads, and I'm gonna be trying to sell you stuff. Oh, you don't want to do that. Just sign up. Okay, now let's get into the movie. Plot spoilers coming. Let's go. I'm about to walk you through the film. I'm going to break down symbolism, conspiracy theories, all that stuff. I'm going to discuss some of the things about the book that you see in the movie and you don't see behind the scenes. It's going to be a great time. I'm excited. Let's get into it. Starts out the classic scene, a beautiful filming of the yellow Volkswagen Bug. That's Jack Nicholson. Jack Torrance is driving this Volkswagen Bug towards the Overlook, where all this stuff happens at this haunted hotel. He's driving up the winding mountain road of Colorado. The credits are rolling. You get the weird ethereal music, creepy sounds. You're like, what is this? And right off the bat, shots fired at Stephen King. The Volkswagen is supposed to be red, because in the book it's red, but it's yellow. Kubrick made it yellow. And we discussed the symbolism of red in my three-part James Shelby Downer King Kill 33 deep dive. Just a couple weeks ago, because red is symbolic of blood, the final phase of alchemy, the rubedo, the red king, as seen in Twin Peaks, the red room, and it's the symbol of soul regeneration, or rebuilding the Temple of Solomon, which I think would have been a much cooler thing to leave into the story. Why did Kubrick take that out? Strange. Especially given his knowledge of symbolism and speaking to the subconscious, you would think the bug would be red, just like in the book. It's possible that one of the reasons why is because he was beefing with Stephen King, as we'll talk about later on in the film. Another idea is that maybe Kubrick was using the alchemical symbolism of yellow, right? Because the idea of alchemy is to turn lead into gold, which gold symbolized by yellow or the sun, the solar mysteries. So pick your favorite theory there, I guess. And also interesting, Volkswagen would be used. It's the people's car of Nazi Germany, because there's a whole angle of Nazis that we'll get into. So we finally see the Overlook Hotel. And the film was actually shot at the Timberline Lodge in Oregon, the exterior shots. But Stephen King wrote the book inspired by the Stanley Hotel in Colorado, right? Which later on, you know, Stephen King would, they would do a TV, made-for-TV series of The Shining that sucks. Or they actually did it at the Stanley Hotel. And the problem was, since Kubrick decided he would never come back to America, they built an interior set in Britain, which was the same set found for the Raiders of the Lost Ark, which starred Harrison Ford as Indiana Jones. Ironically, Eyes Wide Shut's Dr. Bill Harford, played by Tommy Cruise, was named after Harrison Ford. Harrison Ford. And George Lucas was actually filming The Empire Strikes Back at the same time at the same studio. It's called Elstree Studios. So they had to actually share the studio space. And there was an accident on Kubrick's set, and some of his area got destroyed by fire. So George Lucas had to give up some of his space to Stanley Kubrick. And that was also a similar idea as to what happened with the Beach Boys. They had an album, I think it was called Fire, and they were doing a lot of weird, rich, crafty things, and it caught on fire. The studio caught on fire. Now, fun fact, David Lynch was offered to direct Return of the Jedi, because George Lucas was also so impressed by Eraserhead, but David Lynch was like, nah, get out of here, nerd, because he didn't like science fiction. Which is strange, because then he would film Dune, which is very science fiction. And Kubrick lived in Elstree, where the studios were, from 1965. Now, before King wrote The Shining, he was inspired to write it because he stayed at the Stanley Hotel, and the night he stayed there was on October 30th, right? Which is the night before Samhain, which is a sort of ritual blood sacrifice night. The veil was very thin, as they say on Halloween. And he was actually there for their closing night. And the place was basically empty besides Stephen King and his wife, and it was real creepy. And he had this nightmare about his son being chased through the halls with a fire hose, which is part of the book. It's not in the film. So when he wrote The Shining, it was called The Overlook, but it was based on the Stanley. The film was filmed at Timberland Lodge, the exterior shots at Timberland Lodge in Oregon. It gets confusing. But Stephen King hated Stanley Kubrick's Shining so much that he'd get a TV series, and they actually filmed it at the Stanley. All right, back to the movie. Starts out the interview, and Jack walks through the Overlook. He's going to meet Stuart Allman, the general manager of the hotel. Now, if you watch when he goes into Allman's office, look at the location of the office equipment. You'll see a paper, what do you call it? A paper shelf placed at the exact location of Stuart's wiener. Jay Widener found that out. Because there's sexual angles to all of this, which is also in the book. There's a lot of sexuality in the book, too. During this interview, we find out that Jack lives 3.5 hours from the Overlook in Boulder, Colorado. And the Overlook is actually 40 miles from a fictional town called the Sidewinder in the book. Because in the book, they go into the town before the storms hit. But if we're in Colorado, we're talking about Denver, right? Near Denver. Illuminate confirm. You got the Denver International Airport with Lucifer and the Freemasons and all that conspiracies about aliens. You've also got Cheyenne Mountain, which is a deep underground military base. And, Denver's supposedly on the map for occult activity. Now, during the interview, we flash back to Jack's apartment in Boulder. Later on, you hear him talk about how he's got to go back to Boulder, but his wife is back at the apartment in Boulder with Wendy, with their son Danny, and they're having breakfast and cigarettes, as one does in the 70s. And she's casually reading a book called Catcher in the Rye. My goodness. Massive rabbit hole here. And I did a 2-part series on it. I'm going to put a link in the show notes. But the Catcher in the Rye, it ties into a lot of MKUltra type stuff. And incels and crazy stuff. In fact, I interviewed the great Jay Widener and Ryder Lee because they filmed Kubrick's Odyssey 3 after many years of waiting, and it was focused in on this aspect of The Shining with Catcher in the Rye. So I would refer you to listen to my interview with them and then go check out Kubrick's Odyssey 3, and you can knock yourself out. But there's a lot of connections to MKUltra, which we're going to talk about a lot more in this film. You'll notice in their apartment that there's tons of books stacked up just absolutely everywhere. And it could be that because Jack Torrance is a writer, I guess, right? Also notice the red, white, and blue motif. Wendy and Danny's clothes almost entirely throughout the entire movie are always red, white, and blue. You're also introduced to Danny's invisible friend named Tony. Isn't that interesting? He's got an alter. He's got a dissociative identity disorder or an invisible friend. He's a child, after all. So then we go back to the interview, right? And in Stuart Allman's office, you're going to notice there's a lot more America stuff. You got eagles and flags all over the place. Stuart Allman, again, looking like JFK. Jay Weiner came up with that. Also wearing red, white, and blue. And Jay Widener suggests that maybe all this American iconography and colors is to point in the direction of a fake moon landing, right? Because that's Jay Widener's claim to fame, is the fake moon landing conspiracy about The Shining, which is fascinating. We're going to talk about it later. In the book version, there's no discussion about this stuff at all, right? Kubrick puts this in the movie, in the story. In fact, in the book, there's a major beef between Stuart Allman and Jack Torrance. Jack absolutely hates Stuart Allman, which is almost an inversion of the movie. In the movie, Jack Torrance hates his family, but he likes Stuart Allman. But in the book, he hates Stuart Allman, but he really likes his family. It's very interesting. And Allman is kind of a jerk-off in the book. He's a total, like, capitalist, cheapskate jerk-off. So Stuart is telling Jack about how he's just going to have to maintain this hotel. Worst part is going to be the isolation, because you're in there for the whole winter, for like 6 months, from October to March or April or whatever. But good news, Jack is working on a book. So 5 months of peace is exactly what he wants. Also, in the novel version of this story, it's actually a play, because Jack was a high school teacher. He lost his job for losing his temper on a student, and so on. He actually taught at Stovington Prep School. And later on in the movie, Jack, there's no discussion about this in the movie at all, but in the movie later on, he's wearing a Stovington Eagles shirt, which, you know, Kubrick casually throws in there. But in the book, he has a student named George Hatfield, who Jack almost kills because he was being a little shit, messing around with Jack's car, slashing the old Volkswagen tires. But old Jackie boy caught him in the act. Guess he gave him the tombstone or whatever. I don't know what he did. but Jack laments over this throughout the whole book. He's very concerned with his potential for violence. In chapter 27, he has this whole inner monologue telling him how he almost killed George, and maybe he would actually do the same to his own son, Danny, who he loves dearly in the book, because he actually hit Danny once after Danny was messing around with his papers. But then there's one other thing Stuart Allman tells him. He says, not to be melodramatic, but the previous caretaker, Charles Grady, came up with his wife and his two little girls, and he got cabin fever, and he, you know, butchered his wife with his family with an axe and stacked their bodies neatly and then killed himself. No worries, though. No worries. Wendy's really into ghost stories and horror films. She's going to love that. Bitch, what? No, she's not. Jack's a liar. Oh, man. And what's interesting is that the character Grady is interesting, because in this interview, when he's talking about the old caretaker who murdered his family, his name is Charles Grady. But later on, when Jack meets Grady, it's Delbert Grady. And weirder yet, Delbert is a waiter. He's not even a caretaker. So crazy stuff. Also, Grady has two daughters, which inexplicably are depicted by Kubrick as twin sisters. They're not twins in the story anywhere. So now we go back to the apartment. Danny's still talking to Tony, and Tony tells him, hey, Dad got the job, and he's about to call Wendy and let her know. And Wendy's doing dishes, and the phone rings, and sure enough, it's Jack, right?
Tony, do you think Dad'll get the job? He already did. He's gonna phone Wendy up in a few minutes to tell her.
Hello?
Hi, babe.
Hi, hon. How's it going?
Great. Look, I'm at the hotel and I still have an awful lot to go through. I don't think I could get home before 9 or 10.
Sounds like you got the job?
Right. It's a beautiful place. You and Danny are gonna love it.
Tony, why don't you want to go to the hotel?
I don't know.
You do too, no. Now come on, tell me. Don't want to.
And you'll notice that on the fridge, there's a photo of a rocket launch and three big Kool-Aid containers. Now, this makes me think of a lot of things. It makes me think of drinking the Kool-Aid, as in Jim Jones's mass suicide in 1978, but it was Flavor-Aid. Everyone says drinking the Kool-Aid, though. In 1968's Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test, which was a book about Ken Kesey and the Merry Pranksters, they were driving around America trying to get everyone to take LSD. Unbeknownst to them, as part of the CIA mind control, MK Ultra. And he would go on to write One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, which is a film starring Jack Nicholson. So in a way, we have a similar theory as we had with Eyes Wide Shut. The idea that maybe Kubrick hired Tom Cruise to draw attention to his real-life controversies, like the Church of Somethingtology. Like, maybe he hired Jack Nicholson to point to his controversies, because you got this Ken Kesey MK Ultra stuff, which he would put in Clockwork Orange, or maybe the Polanski stuff, which would be even crazier because of the Eyes Wide Shut child trafficking conspiracy theory. And, you know, Ken Kesey loved the LSD so much, he got a job as a janitor at the Menlo Park VA hospital, where he had taken part of the MK Ultra experiments, and he would steal LSD and party with his friends, right? And he would throw LSD into punch bowls, which was very curious because Sidney Gottlieb in Poisoner in Chief in the book, it talks about how he would also do this at CIA parties. Where did he get that? Is he part of the program? Did he know it? Who knows? Now, that photo of the rocket on the fridge is interesting because it could imply reference to Jack Parsons, right? The godfather of rocket science in America, which ties us into the fake moon landing theory as well. Particularly, you can see a parallel of October 30th, which is the night Stephen King stayed at the Stanley. Also, Jack Parsons did his first official rocket launch October 31st in 1936 in the Arroyo Seco, which is the Devil's Gate Dam. And they call this the nativity scene of JPL, Jack Parsons Laboratory, or Jet Propulsion Laboratory, which was the predecessor to NASA. So see how that connects into this fake moon landing thing? And Parsons was known for reciting Aleister Crowley's Hymn to Pan as an invocation before launching rockets, because he thought that rockets were piercing the veil into the realm of the gods. Because all these nerds, they were influenced by all the science fiction and the pulps that they had read their whole lives, like Wernher von Braun and all that stuff. Also, fun fact, in the book, Wendy is described as a golden blonde. She does not have black hair, so that goes right up there with more of this yellow versus red Volkswagen drama. And I don't know why I put that in there right there. Bad location, Isaac. Why did you took the steam out of your Jack Parsons stuff? Ugh. Anyway, the phone rings. It's Jack. We see more books stacked up. Jack tells Wendy he's got the job. He's going to be home late. Whatever, whatever. And Tony, which is Danny's little invisible friend, starts warning him not to go to this hotel. And notice that he's talking to Tony through the bathroom mirror, which is a portal, as discussed in my two-part portal series. And his shirt also has the number 42 on it. And some inverted pentagrams, which connects into the ideas of Satanism. I hate to keep doing this. We're going to revisit 42 symbolism later in part 3. Part 3 is where we unpack all of these conspiracies. I'm just pointing them out as we go through them and giving you a little bit, a little taste. All right. Now, Danny, he's sitting on a big plush teddy bear in this scene, which we'll talk about later, connects into the child trafficking angle. This is symbolism of child trafficking, as you see in Eyes Wide Shut as well. He gets these visions of blood pouring into the elevator lobby. We see Danny screaming. We see the twin girls. Oh, my God, what's about to happen? Nothing good. Next act, I guess, closing day. And we see the family driving up to the hotel through, you know, through the mountainside or whatever you call that. And Danny's hungry. He's hungies. And Jack says, well, you should have ate breakfast. Then immediately they start talking about the Donner Party, who had to eat other people to survive in the winter. And Danny says, oh, I know all about cannibalism. I saw it on the TV.
We must really be high up. The air feels so different.
Mm-hmm.
Dad?
Yes?
I'm hungry.
Well, you should have eaten your breakfast.
We'll get you something as soon as we get to the hotel, okay?
Okay, Mom.
Hey, wasn't it around here that the Donner Party got snowbound?
I think that was farther west in the Sierras.
What was the Donner Party?
They were a party of settlers in covered wagon times. They got snowbound one winter in the mountains. They had to resort to cannibalism in order to stay alive.
You mean they ate each other up?
They had to, in order to survive.
Jack, don't worry, Mom. I know all about cannibalism. I saw it on TV.
See? It's okay. We saw it on the television.
Now, here we go again. More crazy conspiracy stuff getting thrown in the mix. Cannibalism. It's a theory about the elites eating the ultimate forbidden flesh, literally. And strangely enough, it's right when Danny says he's hungry, which is weird. And we talked about this in depth in 2022, there was a film called Fresh. And I did a film analysis on it, and then I did another show where we discussed a book by Kurt Barker called Cannibalism, Blood Drinking, and the High Adept Satanism. It's a very dark rabbit hole, I will forewarn you right now. And basically, we linked the cannibalism to occult rituals of the elites and symbolism of the Sphinx. Human furniture shows up. It's crazy. I should also note that Stephen King, this dialogue about cannibalism is actually in Stephen King's novel as well. So now also during the scene, you get real vibes of Jack being cold, right? He's being a dick. And the thing is, if you grew up in the 80s and 90s, you probably wouldn't think nothing of this. That's just how dads used to be back in the day. But in the movie, Kubrick made this a conscious effort because in the book, it's, Jack is a good guy. He just struggles with addiction. He's trying to redeem himself, all that. So we get back. They're at the Overlook. Jack's in the lobby waiting for Stuart Allman and his assistant to come give him a little tour. And he's casually reading a magazine. And you probably already know where this is going. It's a copy of Playgirl magazine. That's right. A magazine with nude men. Now, if you zoom in on if you find the exact issue that this is, on the cover of this very specific issue is a story called Incest, Why Parents Sleep With Their Children. Huh. Lots of questions here, right? Why is there porn sitting around? No less Playgirl. Especially because they're cleaning up this hotel. Why this specific issue? Is Kubrick alluding to child abuse of Danny from Jack? Stay tuned for more. During the tour, Stuart Allman tells them that only the finest people have stayed here, meaning the elites, meaning the Illuminati bloodlines, which I talked about in Kubrick's Code. Now, to support this claim even further, in the book, I'm going to read you from the book, he actually gives you names. You'll never guess what names. I know it's not Jeffrey Epstein and Bill Gates. Says a man named Robert Townley Watson built it, the grandfather of our present maintenance man. The Vanderbilts have stayed here, and Rockefellers and Astors and DuPonts. Four presidents have stayed in the presidential suite: Wilson, Harding, Roosevelt, and Nixon. Now, this is interesting because Marcella DuPont and Alice Bouvier, which is John Jacob Astor IV's daughter. So those two were like close. They were in attendance at Puharich's 1950 seance for the Nine, which is a very famous ritual seance where they made contact with, I believe, like these aliens from ancient Egypt or some crazy stuff. So this connects into the well. This the nine connects us into the most powerful Illuminati families with extraterrestrial contact, which you know the Rockefellers are really into, right? And the Rockefellers, the Astors, and the DuPonts, they're all listed in the Fritz Springmeier book, The Bloodlines of the Illuminati. And, of course, Rockefeller, a huge component of Eyes Wide Shut. Massive conspiracies here, right? And, you know, extraterrestrials would be the focus of 2001 Space Odyssey in a way, as well as Kubrick's last project, which was AI that he worked on with Steven Spielberg. I think I did a film analysis on AI as well. So you can always check out my index at IlluminatiWatcher.com. I've got an index you can check out and look for every episode. It's like 700-800 episodes. Find the ones you like. Now, Wendy and Jack, they're on the tour. They go through the big Colorado room. Meanwhile, Danny's in the game room, and he's throwing darts. And he has this vision of these twin Grady girls. And right behind them is a skiing poster that says Monarch in huge capital letters. Now, isn't that something? Because Project Monarch is an alleged subprogram of MKUltra. Here we go again, right? And Monarch was studying the genetic passing of information between sibling twins. Yeah. Represented, it's called Monarch and because it's represented by the Monarch butterfly, which you can actually see in the final scene of A Clockwork Orange, as I discuss in Kubrick's Code. The butterfly represents the metamorphosis of the psyche of the victim, creating alters, dissociating, all that, which is in Eyes Wide Shut as going over the rainbow. That's a term they use when you dissociate. And it ties into the theory that they were studying disassociation and ritual abuse in order to program children's minds. And they would allegedly abuse them to force dissociation, creating amnesic barrier, so that later they could be these alters could be used for whatever heinous things they were doing. It's all allegedly, right? Now, I tend to personally believe it because if you look at the history of MKUltra through Artichoke and Bluebird, it all comes back through Operation Paperclip, which is we brought all those Nazis over here. What, you don't think we were trying to do some heinous stuff like the Nazis? I bet they were. The bloodlines of certain people would make for more effective programming, hence the twins. That's why the Project Monarch. And Kathy O'Brien talked about this in Transformation of America. We'll come back to that in the conclusion in part three. But recall that Stuart Allman, literally in the interview, had a whole conversation with Jack about how there's no skiing at the Overlook. Because Jack says, wow, this would be a beautiful place to ski. You'd think you would keep it open in the winter. And he says, no, it'd be way too expensive to keep the roads clear in the winter. So why do they have a skiing poster in this lodge? It makes no sense. There's nobody up there from October to March. And in the room 237 doc, a theorist thinks that the poster is a minotaur because you can see that there's a weird, like, the balance of the body parts isn't normal. And if you read through William Snyder's book, The Minotaur, he connects Kubrick with a guy named Man Ray, who was involved with the Black Dahlia murders. And Kubrick's first production company was called Minotaur, and that is also the name of Man Ray's most famous art, which is a naked woman's upper torso, which some say was inspired by the Black Dahlia murder of Elizabeth Short. Also, there's a ton of ladders that you see when they're walking through the Overlook during the cleanup, which seems kind of normal until you really look at it, right? Until you see how many there are, until you look at their locations. Sometimes they don't even make sense. You're like, where would that ladder even go? And the ladder is symbolism for Freemasonry, and it's about progression of the initiate from the lower ranks to the upper, right? Ascension towards enlightenment. Kind of like how they use the spiral staircase in the degrees of the second degree initiation, which you see in Eyes Wide Shut at the Ziegler Mansion. Talked about this in James Shelby Downer's King Kill 33 series. All right, we're almost done. Hang in there, folks. Hang in there, folks. Wendy and Jack, they're being escorted to their room. Stuart almost says goodbye to two young pretty ladies that are walking by, and Jack is breaking his neck to take a look. My goodness, Jack. Keep it together, old boy. We hear that in 1907, they started building the overlook on Indian burial grounds, and some Native Americans were even attacking the builders. So there's your clear clue as to what's going on with this hotel, right? It's on a Native American burial ground. So Wendy and Jack, they meet Dick Halloran, and he gives them a tour through this massive kitchen. And during this, Dick calls Danny Doc a whole bunch. And Wendy says, how'd you know we call Danny Doc? Because they call him that from the Bugs Bunny cartoon. Plot spoiler, it's because Dick can shine, right? He's got this ability to telepathically connect with Danny. And, you know, Danny cues in on it. Dick asks him if he wants ice cream in his mind, right? So then Dick asks him out loud. He's like, hey, do you want ice cream, Danny? Because Stuart Allman is going to take Wendy and Jack into the basement. Now notice behind Dick, there's a can of Calumet. And we talked about this in Cooper's Code, where you can see the Native American on the can, on the logo for Calumet baking powder, which again is a reference to this Native American genocide theory that people have about the film. And another part of the film worth bringing up at this point is when Jack is talking to Lloyd, the ghost bartender, and says white man's burden, which is a term for the white man needing to imperialize and improve the lives of other people, similar to how they decimated the Native Americans in America, right? Calumet actually literally translates as peace pipe. Now, I've got an update on that. I wrote about white man's burden in the book, but I'm going to come back to that. I'll tell you more about what that really means. So Dick is explaining The Shining to Danny, and I'm going to play this clip. It's kind of long, but it tells us what's happening and how it will play out in the rest of the movie. Take a listen.
Do you know how I knew your name was Doc? You know what I'm talking about, don't you? I can remember when I was a little boy, my grandmother and I could hold conversations entirely without ever opening our mouths. She called it shining. And for a long time, I thought it was just the two of us that had the shine to us. Just like you probably thought you was the only one. But there are other folks, though mostly they don't know it or don't believe it. How long have you been able to do it? Why don't you want to talk about it?
I'm not supposed to.
Who says you ain't supposed to?
Tony.
Who's Tony?
Tony's a little boy that loves my mom.
Is Tony the one that tells you things?
Yes.
How does he tell you things?
It's like I go to sleep, and he shows me things. But when I wake up, I can't remember everything.
Does your mom and dad know about Tony?
Yes.
Do they know he tells you things?
No, Tony told me never to tell him.
Has Tony ever told you anything about this place? About the Overlook Hotel?
I don't know.
Now think real hard, Doc. Think.
I Is there something bad here?
Well, you know, Doc, when something happens, it can leave a trace of itself behind. Say, like, if someone burns toast. Well, maybe things that happen leave other kind of traces behind. Not things that anyone can notice, but things that people who shine can see. Just like they can see things that haven't happened yet. Well, sometimes they can see things that happened a long time ago. I think a lot of things happened right here in this particular hotel over the years. And not all of them was good.
What about room 237?
Room 237?
You're scared of room 237, ain't you?
No, I ain't.
Mr. Allen, what is in room 237?
Nothing. There ain't nothing in room 237. But you ain't got no business going in there anyway. So stay out. You understand? Stay out.
So Danny tells Dick that he's not supposed to discuss The Shining, right? Because Tony, his invisible friend, his alter, tells him not to, which is interesting, right? And he calls him the little boy that lives in his mouth. Could that be a very dark reference to the incestual ordeal or monarch abuse? That section isn't in the book. So Kubrick put that in there. And it's like he goes to sleep and Tony shows him things that he can't remember when he wakes up. It sounds like he's disassociating or he's going over the rainbow, as they say in programming parlance. And Dick asks if Tony has ever told Danny about the Overlook. And he says, think real hard, right? So implying that there's something important that he needs to know about what's going on at the Overlook since they're going to be stuck there for months. And Dick says, when something happens, it can leave a trace of itself behind and only people who shine can sense it, right? Sometimes it's things that haven't happened yet. Sometimes it's things that happened long ago. And Dick says, you know, there's a bunch of stuff that happened in the Overlook that aren't good. So he's trying to parse out what he's experiencing. So apparently it was more than just Grady. Apparently it was more than just the caretaker. And the book provides way more detail on this. And we're going to talk about the elites and the bloodlines and who owned the Overlook, because the book gives you all that information. We're going to talk about that later. But also, this idea was discussed in the book called Cult and the Occult by Peter Brooksmith, which we talked about in the Eyes Wide Shut series, because Kubrick had bought this book, and in the Making of Eyes Wide Shut book, they talk about how Kubrick had underlined certain passages in it that are relevant to abuse of children, basically, because there was this theory of Shunamitism, where even Nazi pilots would, like, they were injured, they would put young virgins against their body and their genitals. It was crazy stuff, right? Talked about that in the Eyes Wide Shut series. Should I put a link in the show notes for the Eyes Wide Shut series? Well, why not? I think I have an index for you. Let me put a link there. You can take a listen to that Eyes Wide Shut series while you're waiting on part two to come out here. But anyway, the book, Cult No Cult, to be fair, was published in 1985, which is after The Shining. So Kubrick did not reference that book for The Shining. But what's interesting is that in Cult No Cult, there's a chapter called Gateway to the Other Worlds. And in it, it describes kind of like the ideas of The Shining here. It says, nature generates fields of static electricity in certain places, often near running water. These fields are capable of picking up and recording the thoughts and feelings of humans and creatures. There's also a mild electrical field all around us, which is why people can walk into a room where a murder happens and sense the energy left in the field. It also talks about how there's a dream state that exists at a higher frequency, which is, you know, kind of like what you see in the movie Inception with time dilation or Twin Peaks. It talks about how the human body can be tuned like a machine to pick up on certain vibrations or frequencies. And it's kind of sort of related to the ideas of sex magic as a way of reaching this altered state or tapping into another realm. And this is what The Shining is about. It's about tapping into another realm. And that's why people, I argue, love this movie so much. It's showing us something that we can all sense. This is very similar to why Twin Peaks is so effective. It's the anima mundi. It's the vast underground reservoir of memory of all of the past human experiences, thoughts, dreams, hopes, and so on. Which some people would say, like Helena Blavatsky would call it the Akashic Record. David Lynch would practice transcendental meditation, which would get you in touch with the unified field. These are all very similar, right? Now, in the book, in the novel, this scene where Dick is talking to Danny takes place in a car, and Wendy is like kind of nervous about what they're discussing. She's watching it, right? Now, what's interesting is that it's in chapter 11 of The Shining, which the number 11 is the number for magic, right? As per Aleister Crowley. And in the book, they talk about dreaming while being awake and how sometimes it's like seeing pictures in a book. And Danny says, yeah, it's kind of like the story of Bluebeard, which is strange because if you look up the story of Bluebeard, it's about, and I don't know the story. I just researched it for this series. It's about a wealthy man who marries a young woman and he gives her the keys to his mansion and tells her, look, the whole mansion's yours. There's one room you can't go in, though. Just one specific room. Because it turns out it's loaded down with the bodies of all his previous wives. And this is very much parallel to the idea of room 237. It's the one room he can't go in because Grady, the caretaker, had stacked up the bodies in there. It's the hidden chamber. Only those who are initiated can enter, because if you don't, you can go crazy. And at the end of the scene, Danny asks about room 237, and Dick, he starts tripping out. He's like, do not go to room 237, because he knows all this. And that's where we end our first episode in the three-part series. What can you do now? You can subscribe to the show so you don't miss out on part two. I'm dropping it very soon. It'll be the next episode. And if you like this so much, you can go check out the video version. Go sign up for tier 2 on patreon.com/Illuminati Watcher or the VIP section. Tier 2 gets you access to the ad-free video of this show where I play the movie clips and you'll see some images and so on. It makes a lot more sense when you can watch it visually. But yeah, make sure you're subscribed to the show. However, free feed or not, it's up to you. But I do appreciate listening, and I assure you, this series is going to be mind-blowing. So be sure to come back for part two, where we're going to finish the film, all right? Because there's a lot more to unpack in the film. Then in part three, we're going to go through the whole thing and break down what exactly is happening here, the symbolism, the deep esoteric cuts about what's going on with all kinds of crazy stuff from MK Ultra to abuse of all kinds. So thank you for listening to the show. Till next time, stay positive.